This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Jerry Clinton, and this is Night Transmissions number 55. 55. That means I've been doing these for a year. Actually, a little more than a year. I do one a week. I've told this before, and some of you may have heard it, but I'll keep it brief. Night Transmissions started nearly 2 years ago when an acquaintance of mine who was connected with a local low-power FM station was looking for help in figuring out how to use a computer to record his radio show. I'm a friendly fellow, and even though I had absolutely no interest in performing on the radio, I was willing to help Mike, his name was Mike Kennedy, figure out how to get what he wanted done, which really was just to get his show onto a CD. That was really all, so that he could then take it down, slap it down in one of their CD players, hit the broadcast button, settle back, and have himself a show. I found myself getting more involved in this radio project than I had had any intention of doing. I ended up, well, he called me his engineer. I never really accepted that. That was kind of way too grand. Well, stuff happened. Mike died. It's distressing how often people do that. And I ended up with a radio show, which by then I had begun to enjoy. I still don't really particularly enjoy doing the hosting part. When Mike was alive, I made him do almost all of the hosting stuff, which was okay because he enjoyed it. But now, I guess if I'm going to do a radio show, I'm stuck with it. And I'm sorry to say, ladies and gentlemen, so are you. I do enjoy most of it, really. I enjoy tracking down the old radio programs. I enjoy finding the audio shorts, the old ads. I enjoy the research that I do to try to make this show informative. I enjoy the geeky part, too. Finding out about microphones and other related technologies. I enjoy the engineering aspect of it. I don't think of myself as a sound engineer. I mean, that would be ridiculous. I'm just a guy with a computer, a guy who figured out how to use a program called Audacity. And not all that well at that. Anyway, this show really isn't about me, or it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be about content. Now, from January the 11th of 1949...
Tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you... Escape! Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight, we escape to the English Channel in wartime and to a harrowing night crossing those gray, cold waters in a small boat with the threat of instant death in command, as David Devine tells it in his exciting story, Flood on the Goodwins.
That one?
Where?
Off to starboard.
No, it's a mattress.
Blasted fog. Couldn't see the living, let alone the dead.
I don't think we'll be finding any more.
Not the way the fog is settling down now. Where do you figure the patrol boat is?
She ought to be about a couple of hundred yards to port. Take it easy now, Uncle. Don't want to ram her.
Don't you worry about me, Dundas. Just you start singing out.
Patrol boat ahoy! Patrol boat ahoy!
Ahoy! Who are you?
Captain Mac of the Mary D.
They're starting to be dead ahead, Mac. Better cut it back. Oh, I see her.
They'll come about her.
We're coming around your stern.
Get any more?
Yes, three. Watch out for those dinghies.
I see them.
Bear a hand there. Three more coming aboard. Any alive?
No, all three drowned.
Come on, Mac. Let's get them up there.
Don't you bother, Dundas. Hey there. You send down a couple of men.
Sure.
My mate here, he's only got one flipper.
Oh, now, look, Mac, that doesn't make any difference.
What's the matter? You ashamed of it?
Oh, well, no, but...
Forward there, men.
Forward right.
I can swing my load like any man.
Be sure I get my top back.
Sorry.
Don't let it get you, boy. There's lots of amputees working these days.
Amputee? Look, must you use that expression?
Amputee is what you call a one-armed man. Amputee. What's wrong with it? Better than what you call those things. They're hoisting there.
Amputee. I hate that word.
Bloaters. You call them. Man's been floating around dead in the water. He gets bloated, see? Bloated.
Very pretty. You know what you call a gabby old goat like you?
Never mind.
That's the bunch.
How many been brought into you so far?
Counting your three, that makes 30.
30? You don't say.
Lucky we got this fog. Without it, we'd be sitting ducks for any Stukas or Messerschmitts that might be about.
Or U-boats.
That's right.
Was it a U-boat sent her down?
No. Man they brought in an hour ago, he said it was a time bomb.
Sabotage.
Yes. Went off in the forward hole. Huh? Boom, bubble, bubble, bubble.
Boom, bubble, bubble. You hear that, Dundas?
I heard.
My nephew lost his flipper in the RAF. Taking it real hard.
You shouldn't take it hard.
No, who says I shouldn't?
No, don't get sore, laddie. I'm just trying to cheer you, don't you know?
Yes, well, cheer me by getting your feet off this boat so we can shove off.
Sure, laddie, sure.
Casting off.
Going back to Dover?
Might as well. Fog's in for the night. We'll just make it by dark.
Hello. Cheerio.
Cheerio. You didn't have to bite his head off.
Lay off me, man.
Didn't mean any harm.
I said lay off, Mac, lay off.
All right.
30 of them.
So that's what's eating you.
A saboteur. Can you imagine doing a thing like that? Can you see a man doing it?
Well, it's war, you know.
War. Fighting is war.
They didn't all drown.
No, only 29 of them. Didn't they say one was alive?
Yes.
It must be awful to drown. It's an awful way to die.
Wonder if it'll clear tomorrow.
Wharf up ahead.
Yes. Good navigating, Dundas.
Ought to be right ahead of us. Mary? We're coming in, dear. Dead ahead, Mac.
All right.
There, I'll jump it.
Hello, you two.
Hello, Mary.
Hello.
How was it, Uncle Mac?
Terrible, dear. Just terrible.
Were there many?
30.
Oh, dear.
That's it.
Mac, how's the fuel?
Ample. We didn't use a quarter of it.
Are you going to fish tonight?
Ask Mac. It's his boat.
Fishing tonight, Uncle Mac?
In this fog? I should say not.
Dundas can navigate for you in the water. They say it's as calm as a bathtub.
Well, I don't know.
I brought you food in case you're going out again.
I don't know. I think that husband of yours needs some sleep.
Are you going to start again?
What's wrong?
All day long he's complaining like an old woman. Just because he's had the bad luck to lose his fin.
Being flipper, why can't you say arm?
See what I mean?
Well, you know you are a little rough about it, Uncle Mac.
Well, what ought I do? Help him feel sorry for himself?
I'll cut it, both of you.
There was a man to see you, Uncle Mac.
Who?
We didn't say. He said he'd drop back.
Well, what did he look like?
Very tall, distinguished looking.
Who's that, Mac?
Got me. Tall, you say?
Mm-hmm. And carrying a little briefcase.
Come for the payments on the boat, Mac.
No. Would this be him?
Hmm? Oh, yes. You're back. Just in time to catch them.
Good, very good.
You were looking for me?
Yes. Yes, you're Captain Mac.
That's right.
And who is this?
Mr. Dundas, my nephew.
The husband of this lady.
Look, mister, who are you and what do you want?
It's very simple. You must forgive my questioning. When one is engaged in my work, one can't be too careful.
Your work?
Intelligence.
Ooh.
What's that got to do with us?
I want to charter your boat for a trip.
Oh, government work, eh?
Yes. A secret mission.
Where is it you want to go?
To Ostend, tonight.
Belgium, that's a fair haul. And there's your boats.
The fog will cover you.
What do you pay?
The Crown provides handsomely in these cases. £100.
Get on.
Wait a minute, Mac.
Huh?
Mind showing us your credentials, mister?
I shouldn't mind at all, fellow. Fact is, I'm not carrying any.
You're not, huh?
This isn't what you'd call a casual visit, you know.
Oh, use your head, Dundas. He's going where the Nazis are.
No credentials. And would you mind explaining why you're snipping around in a little fishing boat like this when you could cross in one of those big, fast torpedo boats they got over at the yard?
I find this man insufferable, Captain. Now, what do you say? Time's growing short.
Why don't you take the torpedo boat? Or the sweeper. They got sweepers there, too, you know.
As a matter of fact, and you should be able to understand, those are government boats. Might be seen by one of the enemy shore stations.
In this fog? You're a liar, mister.
And you are a very astute fellow. Into the boats, all of you.
A gun.
Yes, my ticket to Ostend.
Put that thing down.
Look out, Mac. You're serious.
Indeed I am. Now, in.
Do what he says, Mac.
Start your motor.
Make me.
Shall I?
Start it, Mac.
This is crazy.
You, untie the ropes. Jumis, sit up there.
You don't stand a chance.
We shall see. I'll sit up front with the lady.
Front? You don't know much about boats, do you?
No, and I shan't pretend to.
Listen, mister. The harbor entrance is closed up. They got the submarine nets in there.
I happen to know they're open until 8. I'd better warn you, no tricks. I'm very good with a gun.
You are, eh? Dundas. He says he's very good.
Shut up and let's go.
So, you're a Nazi.
That's right.
You talk like an Englishman.
Oh, really?
A Nazi. What are you, a spy?
You could say that.
What are you going back to the continent for? The war's not over.
What time do you think we'll hit the Belgian coast?
Around 2. You didn't answer my question.
What was that?
Why are you leaving England? Scared?
If you like. As a matter of fact, I'm returning because I've completed my mission.
And what was that?
Matter of a bomb.
Sabotage?
Naturally.
That ship. The one that went down off the coast. Was that your work?
Yes. I planted the bomb in the hold this morning before she sailed from Dover.
Stinking, filthy, bloody...
Hold it, Mac. Hold it.
Don't let him curse. I find him an amusing old gaffer.
30 men drowned because of you.
30? Dear me. There were 45 aboard, you know.
It was 29, Mac.
29, 30? What does it matter? This big, skinny Nazi, this sneak in the dark with his mission completed?
As a matter of fact, we were only joking, mister. Nobody was drowned.
What are you talking about? 29?
Your sense of security is a little delayed, One Arm.
Don't you call me One Arm.
Oh, sorry.
What's the time, Dundas?
Quarter of.
Ought to be passing Goodwin Sands.
Tide will be over them now.
What time do they expose this time of year?
Low tide's at 1.
That means we get a fast ride back anyhow.
If he lets us come back.
Lousy Nazi. How do we know you won't kill us when we let you off?
You have my word.
Yeah.
Oh, don't take on, dear.
I can't help it. I'm frightened.
Let her come back here with us.
No.
See how tough he is? Shoots women.
If necessary.
I'd like to see you get that close to me.
Would you?
Yes. Look, Nazi. I'm walking toward you.
Matt, don't.
We're asking for it, you know.
Bloody Nazi pig.
Don't take another step, Captain.
Look, Mary! Bloody pig!
Uncle Mary!
He can't hear you, girl. Don't slow down, one arm.
I want to get him.
He's dead. He's very dead.
He was a good man. He deserves burial.
And burial he's got. I'll push your throttle back up.
No.
Your wife is next, one arm.
Dundas!
That's better. And now, we continue our little voyage.
In just a moment, we will return to Escape. But first...
Have you noticed how many people are changing to Craven Egg?
Yes, I wonder why.
It's simply that Craven Egg filters best.
Did you say Craven Egg filters best?
Yes, you'll be surprised at the satisfaction you get in Canada's most advanced cigarette.
And now back to Escape and the second act of Blood on the Goodwins.
How much longer, Dundas?
About an hour.
I notice you change course from time to time. Why is that?
The channel current. You ride with it, you make better time.
I see. And you'd like to be rid of my company as quickly as possible.
That's right.
I'm glad you're being reasonable. The old man was a fool.
You think so, eh?
Of course, and so do you.
Why do you say that?
You've seen the war. You know how it is.
That's right, I know how it is.
Dundas, don't talk like that.
Why? What's wrong, Mary?
Don't talk with him. He killed Uncle Mac. It's not right to talk to him.
Well, we find each other very interesting, Mary. Don't we?
Oh, yes, indeed. Tell me, how did you lose your arm?
RAF. I was a navigator.
A very good one, I imagine.
Yes.
Did it, happen over England?
No, Bremen.
Bremen? I see. You chaps did a very thorough job at Bremen.
Yes.
You ought to be complimented.
Thank you.
Dundas!
Relax, Mary, relax.
You must understand, Mary.
What?
May I call you Mary? You must understand, it's a very extraordinary thing for the soldiers of warring nations to get together for a chat like this.
Take a nap, Mary.
Take a nap?
Yes, why don't you? Here. You can pull this tarpaulin over.
No, not that.
What?
It's got blood on it, that tarpaulin.
Blood? But really, the old man was over there, didn't you
not
see?
Not from him.
Oh?
We spent the day picking up after you.
I see. And you used the tarpaulin for the bodies?
Yes.
Well, then, Mary, of course we mustn't use that.
Please. Please, may I go back to where my husband is?
No, you may not.
Why? Why can't
I'll tell you why you may not. You two are desperate, despite your husband's conversational manner. I should like to avoid the possibility of your rushing me.
You see how it is, Mary?
I'm sure she understands.
Just be very quiet, Mary. Everything will be all right.
Of course, a lot depends on you, Dundas.
Why do you say that?
Don't you know what I'm talking about?
Why, no.
That wrench you picked up about 15 minutes ago. It's right behind you on the ledge.
Thwart.
Thwart, then. It's right behind you on the thwart. Do you mind dropping it overboard like a good fellow?
Oh, that'd be a foolish waste. Wartime, you know, wrenches are hard to come by.
Yes, I'm sure. And why not slide it over here?
All right.
Huh? Slide it. Even if you could hit me accurately enough to disable me, the gun would go off and... You know?
I know. Here.
Thank you, Dennis. Now then, where were we?
Soldiers from warring nations.
Oh, yes. Remarkable meeting. Gives us a chance to refresh ourselves on what it is we're fighting about.
Dundas is fighting men who sabotage ships.
Was, you mean, don't you?
Was. Now I fight nothing.
So I envy you. Unfortunately, I am still able. So, miss, carry on.
Well, I find it a little difficult to... Oh, excuse me.
What's wrong?
Navigation. I have to check my course.
Oh, by all means. What course are you steering?
Why don't you come and look?
No, I don't think I'd better.
Why not?
You might have another wrench there. Or perhaps you'll try to take my gun. Which case, I'd have to shoot. Have to kill you. Then where would I be? I might steer all the way back to Dover without knowing it.
That's so.
And then I should have to kill your wife so she wouldn't inform. You see how it is.
How do you know I'm not tricking you?
Oh, I'm sure you're not. If we don't arrive by 3, I'm going to kill her anyway. Then, if you should continue to be stubborn, there are ways of forcing you.
You mean torture?
Ordinarily, it's very difficult to do alone. But in your case, one armed, it should be comparatively simple.
Well, let's not waste words on all that. I'm taking you where you want to go. And I'm counting on you to keep your word to allow a safe departure.
Well, of course.
I don't believe in Dundas.
But why? Why not?
Because you're what you are. And because Dundas might know something your people want to find out. Dundas, don't you see that they'll torture you? He's lying, Dundas.
Please, Mary, please, don't worry.
You have my word. My sacred words on my honor as a gentleman.
You see, Mary, we have nothing to worry about.
Yes, it must be wonderful to be out of the fighting.
Not bad.
I'll be glad when it's over.
Think it'll be over soon?
Quite. You've heard of our buzz bombs.
Yes.
That's only the beginning. We're developing weapons 1,000 times as terrible. Oh, 10,000 times as effective.
Really? Tell me about them.
Your wife seems to have gone to sleep.
Where? I can't see very well in this dark.
Against my knee.
Good. About your new weapons. You were saying 10,000 times as terrible.
Yes, there are rockets, the like of which the English have not dreamed. Rockets that can travel 100 miles, 300. No one knows what their limitations will be. Radio controlled. Speed about 30,000 miles an hour. Altitude, 60 miles. And what they will carry, I leave to your imagination.
Why leave it to my imagination?
What?
You wouldn't tell me all this. Highly secret business, if it were your intention to allow us safe departure, now, would you?
I'm sure your agents know this by now.
I don't know. But something tells me you've come to a decision about us.
How much longer until we hit shore?
Not long now. I'm bringing her into a deserted beach a few miles outside of Ostend.
I see.
If you look ahead, you may see the shoreline soon.
Straight ahead?
Yes.
It's impossible. This fog is too much to...
What?
I've got it, Dundas!
Give me that gun, you...
Here, Dundas.
Good work, Mary. Stand back, fellow. That's it. Now raise them good and high.
Oh, Dundas, I thought he'd never drop his wrist. I waited and waited.
Here, Mary, take the wheel. Hold that course.
Yes, Dundas.
Well, well. It's a remarkable woman, your wife.
Yes, indeed.
Unfortunately, there's no cartridge in the chamber.
Well, it's pointed at your gut. Why don't I pull the trigger and see if you're telling the truth?
Perhaps you'd better not.
I don't see why not, if it's empty.
No. No, it's loaded.
Huh?
I wonder if you're the type who can kill the man he's facing.
I don't know. I've never done it.
It's very difficult, you know. Just think of me as a fellow human being, flesh and blood like yourself. Think of the infinite genius that went into making this body of mine. Skin, muscles, arteries, veins, organs, vessels in the blood. The blood... Murder is a very difficult thing when you're face to face with the murdered.
I know. I don't feel as though I could kill you right at this minute. But suppose I try. All I have to do is squeeze the trigger ever so little.
Wait. No, don't.
Why not?
My life is worth a lot to me. More, believe it or not, than my pride, my honor, my love of Germany. Oh, much, much more than that.
All right, have you a proposition?
Dundas!
Be still, Mary. I know what I'm doing.
Yes, you keep out of this.
What's your proposition?
Money. You're going to need money, aren't you? A one-arm has a tough time of it in peacetime. Jobs are hard to get.
Go on.
I have several accounts in London banks. Big accounts. I can write you a check. You can cash it tomorrow.
How much?
£1,000.
I can't hear you.
Anders, don't do this.
2,000. 3. 5, then. And that's all the money I have in the world.
What about on you?
Yes. In the briefcase. £150.
I'll don't
get...
move.
But the briefcase...
I'll take care of that after you leave. Write the check for £5,000.
Oh, Anders, please. Please don't do it.
Her wife doesn't understand these things.
No. This is the way of the world, dear.
Dundas.
And for this, I let you off at the beach. Of course, I want to warn you against mentioning my name.
But of course. Here's your check.
Thank you.
Aren't you going to shoot me now?
No. Bargain's a bargain. I'll follow through.
Why, you are an honest man.
Deal's a deal.
Yes, that's right.
I'd better take the wheel.
Shall I take the gun, Dundas?
No.
Please, Dundas, please, let me hold it.
No, Mary.
Well, why in the name of heaven can't I? You can't steer and cover him at the same time, not with one hand.
If you take the gun, you'll shoot him, Mary. I know you.
Oh, no, I wouldn't.
Yes, you would. And that'd be dishonest, Mary. We've made a deal, this man and I.
Yes, an honorable deal.
But how to steer and all, that does pose a problem. Mary, bring me that big wrench.
All right, Dundas.
What are you going to do?
Well, since I can't handle the wheel and the gun, and since Mary's not to be trusted, I'll keep the wrench for just in case. And solve the gun problem very simply.
Dundas, you fool!
And you sir, idiot. You'll find a fishing line with lead on the end of it right up there in the front locker.
Yeah, what?
I'm going to slow down now. We're almost there. You'll do the sounding for me.
Yes, of course.
You deliberately threw that gun overboard. You're selling out.
£5,000, dear. As the Yanks put it, that ain't hay.
I have the line.
All right, throw it ahead of you. Then feel when it touches bottom. Then measure the depth by your spread arms.
Here it goes.
Oh, Dundas, darling. Darling, I know the war's a shock to you, losing your arm and all, but don't do this. You'll regret it. You'll regret it all the rest of your days.
Hit bottom.
How deep?
2, 3, 4, 5. 5, that's all.
All right, we're closing in on the coast. Swing again.
Right.
We'll hear the surf in a minute now. It'll not be very strong. It's low tide, you know.
2, 3, 1/2.
All right, get ready to jump.
Jump?
Now, this boat hasn't got wheels. You'll have to walk the last 10 feet in.
All right.
Get ready. Here we are. The minute you feel a scrape bottom, jump out and push the bow around.
Right.
Dundas.
Shh. Here I go.
Good night.
Good night, sucker.
Why, sucker?
That check. The bank is short of funds to the name I signed.
Oh, really? On the beach?
Yes, I'm on it.
Take a few steps.
Why?
You'll see.
It stops. There's water beyond.
The bank is short of funds. That beach is short of sand.
Where am I?
You're on Goodwin Sands. Dover's just 6 miles that way.
Which way?
I didn't say. And if you're thinking of swimming, I can tell you, you don't stand a chance.
You thief! You one-armed murderer!
It's low tide now, but wait a while. In a few hours, it'll be 10 feet over your head. Drowning's not pleasant, Nazi. If you had your gun, you could shoot yourself. You could hang yourself with your belt, but there are no trees. So think about those men you drowned today. Think about them while you wait. I may be around to pick up your body soon. Maybe.
Wait.
Good night, bloater.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson. Tonight we have presented Flood on the Goodwins by David Devine, adapted for radio by James Poe. Featured in the cast were Jack Edwards as Dundas, Will Gear as Uncle Mac, and Barton Yarborough as the Nazi. Also heard were Betty Lou Gerson and Eric Snowden. Special music was arranged and conducted by Del Castillo. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Guess what? This is a break. And no, I don't really like it either. At least I get to run off and hide until it's over. I'll be back real soon. I really like what's coming up next. From Britain, we have a series featuring an American actor, someone I'm sure you're familiar with, Vincent Price, and a show called The Price of Fear, which ran on the BBC between 1972 and 1982. It seems odd to think that during that 10-year period, there were only 22 episodes made. But they are some of the finest examples of old-time radio existent. Vincent Price narrated these stories as though he himself had actually lived them. Well, not all of the stories. There are some stories where he's just the narrator, but most of them, he takes the part of, well, not really the protagonist either. Generally, it'll open up with him being on some trip, stopping off where he knows somebody, visiting a friend in some distant land where he's on some errand related to his business or his hobbies. And somehow, he always gets drawn into these macabre tales, like this show. It starts out with Vincent minding his own business on a train when a unprepossessing man sits down next to him and very shortly begins to tell him a very personal story, his discovery of his unfaithful wife, and the hints that he leaves to convince her to drop the affair.
The Price of Fear. Brought to you by Vincent Price. Train trips fascinate me. How about you? If the answer is yes, then this story, which I have chosen to call The Man Who Hated Scenes, might well appeal to you. Indeed, for some of you listening, even the notion of making a long train journey across the United States will conjure up a world of limitless possibilities. The world seems yours for the asking. Right from that first whistle blow, right from the first shudder as the giant locomotive grips the tracks and pulls its human cargo away from the commonplace and the familiar towards the romantic and the unknown. Others of you, of course, might prefer to regard such a journey as simply a respite, a period of temporary seclusion, a chance to simply sit and think. My own inclinations vary, and I suspect come somewhere in between. In any event, be it in the diner of a train speeding across the States or in the kitchen of my own home, I have always considered conversation at breakfast as something of a chore. And so it was, as I watched the little man coming towards me, my feelings were a mixture of resentment and dismay. His voice proved as tentative and deferential as his general demeanor.
You won't mind if I share your table?
The fact that the rest of the diner was still completely empty and the stranger seemed perfectly prepared for me to refuse ultimately made no difference to my polite reply.
Will you?
Oh, no, please do. I'd be glad for the company.
Oh, many thanks. Insomnia. Don't you know? I've been a martyr to it all my life.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. But still, it's nice to know I'm not going to be the only one coming in for breakfast this early.
Oh?
Yes, when I came in a few minutes ago, the dining car attendant looked as though he'd just got out of his pajamas and could certainly see no reason why I wasn't still in mine.
But he wasn't angry, was he?
Well, let's just say not your usual service with a smile.
I see. You must forgive my asking. It's just that I could perfectly well come back later if it were more convenient for them. Well, there's no point in making a scene, is there? I do so hate scenes.
He glanced nervously away as the same sleepy waiter approached us from the service area. He gave his order in an apologetic, hardly audible voice.
Just coffee and lightly scrambled eggs, please.
Are you going all the way to New York?
Oh, much further, much further. I'm traveling on the QE2. We embark on Thursday.
Oh, home to England, then?
Oh, no, not for a long time yet. Cherbourg first, then the Sun, the Riviera, perhaps, Italy, the Greek islands. I haven't made up my mind.
Oh, I do envy you.
Then you shouldn't.
No?
No, it's just a case of doctor's orders. It's my nerves, you know. It's any kind of excitement to be avoided at all costs.
Yes. Yes, I do understand.
I think you really do. For some unknown reason, I'm sure you do. Sir, my friend, you can imagine the kind of state I got myself into when I discovered my wife was being unfaithful to me, can't you?
Your wife?
Marilyn. So beautiful, so very, very beautiful. Oh, but perhaps you'd care to judge for yourself. I just happened to have... It's only a snapshot, but it doesn't do her justice, really. But, yes, here we are. It was taken at the side of the pool, don't you know? Our pool.
It's very impressive.
Marilyn loved that pool.
I'd accepted and studied the photograph. The sleepy waiter had returned and was grudgingly serving my companion's breakfast. Yes, the girl was certainly beautiful. There was no denying that fact. Even though the photographer had caught her just on the point of emerging from the pool, her charms were not only obvious, but a trifle too obvious. The high diving board framed her head. It reminded me somewhat disconcertingly of a gallows.
I ordered scrambled eggs, didn't I?
What? Yes. Yes, I'm sure you did, but they've brought you fried.
So bad for the digestion, don't you know? Oh, well, these things are sent to try us.
Oh, nothing of the kind. I'll ring for the service.
No, please don't. I do so hate scenes, you see. Please.
Well, just as you wish.
Thank you. I suppose it's fortunate for me. I've never been short of money. It really is a wonderful insulator, old man. It protects me from all kinds of anxieties the average man can't avoid. It's probably why I've never objected when I've been overcharged or anything like that. Far easier to pay up. Remain calm.
You were telling me about your wife.
Marilyn. Oh, yes. Beautiful. So beautiful. The most beautiful creature I've ever seen, or I'm ever likely to see. I thought so right from the very beginning.
Where was that?
It was at a resort in Florida. She was a swimmer before our marriage. Almost made the Olympic team.
Did she really?
Yes, really. Anyway, she was doing some exhibition dives from the high board into the hotel pool. She was wearing a white bathing suit. I remember seeing her poise high above me. She seemed a positive goddess incarnate. Diana turned mermaid instead of huntress. Does that sound fanciful?
No. No, not at all.
I didn't think it would. Do you? I never thought I was in with much of a chance, though. She was a good 20 years younger and always in the company of half a dozen bronzed Apollos. But, well, we just seemed to hit it off right from the start. The difference in age didn't seem to matter.
A case of mind over matter.
I suppose you could put it like that. In any event, within a month, Marilyn and I became husband and wife and were off on our honeymoon. We were so very happy.
And afterwards you returned home.
Home? It's a big Spanish type of place just outside Santa Barbara. A truly beautiful spot. I don't think I ever wanted to leave that house ever again. It gave me the seclusion and peace my nerves required. I had everything I ever wanted.
And Marilyn?
Oh, for a long time, she loved the place, too. We'd splash about in our pool every day, and often I'd just lie in the sun and watch her diving. And sometimes...
Yes?
Sometimes we'd send the servants away for the day, and if you'll pardon the expression, we'd swim in the nude. Well, it was genuinely idyllic, my friend. In an age when all the graciousness seems to have gone out of life, idyllic. So much so that when it finally came, Marilyn's outburst took me completely by surprise.
What's so surprising about it, for God's sake? And you needn't think I'm so dumb as to not realize what you're getting out of this setup either.
Getting out of this
setup? Getting, yes. This place, miles from anywhere, perched on the edge of nowhere. Well, it exactly suits your ends, doesn't it?
I thought you liked the house.
A rich, eccentric, middle-aged recluse, comfortably ensconced in his 20-bedroomed ivory tower.
I've always felt you shared my preference for the solitary life.
But not the godforsaken.
I don't understand what you're getting at, Marilyn.
Don't you? Really? For a gentleman of your intelligence and breeding, I should have thought it altogether too obvious. However, I'll tell you. Quite simple.
Marilyn, do you think you ought to drink so much?
You didn't have the guts to stay on here and go it completely alone. So, for once in his life, one hermit ventured forth. He took a little trip into the big outside world with the deliberate intention of trapping a little spouse to keep him company.
I've never thought of our marriage as a trap.
Ego being what it is, I'm damn sure you haven't. Oh. But take it from me, it was just an arrangement, right from the start. An arrangement to suit your own ends.
I've always tried to put your happiness first.
Huh. Happiness. That's a word from the past.
But I've given you everything you've ever asked for. Everything.
I'll grant you the bait was acceptable enough at first.
Bait?
Of the very finest quality, there's no denying. But bait, Harry... You made the whole arrangement seem irresistible, didn't you?
But...
The world was to be our oyster, remember? New places, new faces, forever and ever, world without end. Amen. Oh, you really had me believing it, too. Right up to the end of the honeymoon, you actually had me believing it.
And afterwards?
Well, the honeymoon was over, wasn't it? So was the new faces, new places routine. And in its place, this. A cage, damn you. Oh, well up to the standard you taught me to expect, I'm not denying. But a cage for all that.
Madison, I love you. Right from that first moment.
You knew that you wanted me, so you wooed me and you won me. You moved me into your millionaire's Alcatraz and then you threw away the keys.
I still love you.
Oh, maybe you do. Enough to go back?
Back where?
To where the arrangement started going wrong. To our original arrangement, Harry. New places, new faces, forever and ever, world without end.
It is not an arrangement. It never has been.
It still is. And shall I tell you something else? It's never going to be anything more, Harry. Poor Harry. Poor Harry.
Have some more coffee.
Oh, thank you.
So she got her own way then.
New places, new faces. If it had been in my power, she would have got her way. If it had been in my power, I'd have given her anything. Knowing what a person is doesn't necessarily mean you stop loving them, does it?
No, I suppose not. So you left the house?
Hmm? Oh, no. No, it never came to that. Oh, it was what Marilyn had insisted upon and what I'd agreed to. A really long trip abroad. A chance for us to find each other again. Extraordinary how absolute naivety has a charm of its own. But as things turned out, it simply wasn't to be.
Oh?
Well, on the eve of our departure, I was taken ill. Desperately ill.
As a result of the quarrel?
Well, my doctor called it acute emotional stress. You see, I've never been able to stand scenes of any kind, and in this case, well, my only defense was a period of total mental withdrawal, a self-inflicted coma, if you like. It went on for a long time, over a month.
And then?
It refused to go on any longer.
Did Marilyn stand by you?
Marilyn? Ah, yes, Marilyn. Marilyn? 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 Marilyn!
It's all right. I'm here.
Oh, dear God.
Marilyn. Easy now. You've been ill, Harry. Very ill.
Yes, I have been ill, haven't I? I'm so sorry, Marilyn.
Shush. The only important thing now is that you get well again. The doctor's been very worried for you.
And you? Did you worry for me too, Marilyn?
Oh, yes. I worried.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for worrying.
Oh,
No, you were quite right. I've been selfish and thoughtless, thinking only of myself. But I'll make it up to you. You'll see, I'll make it all up to you.
Of course you will. By simply getting well again.
Yes, that's it. Well again. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then we'll make that long trip together, eh? Just the two of us, just as we planned to do.
No.
Pardon?
There's not going to be any trip, Harry. Not just yet. Not for a long, long time.
But I thought that was what you wanted.
It was.
Well?
And then you became sick. And I realized I wanted something else much more. I wanted you to get well again. So that we could always be together. Together here, Harry. I wanted this place for just the two of us. I wanted to look after you and care for you here in our own home, Harry. And I decided that the most important thing in the world for me was to make it into a real home. Not some kind of show place. What? Not some kind of domestic hotel either, where everything gets done for you at the press of a button.
I'm not sure I understand.
It's perfectly simple. I got rid of the servants, Harry.
Servants?
We never really needed them. Don't you see? It was they that came between us, Harry. Our only real happiness came when we were allowed to be alone together.
But how are we going to manage without it?
Easily. I've already arranged it all, and it's working wonderfully. A woman comes up from town every morning to take care of the heavy work. I can get anything we need by making a phone call and having it delivered. Well, what more do we need? What more can we ask, huh?
Nothing, my love. Nothing.
Just the two of us.
Just the two of you. And tell me, did it work out like that?
No. No, not quite like that.
Well, how?
As the weeks went by and I got steadily stronger, Marilyn thought the occasional change of scene might speed my recovery. Nothing too far afield, mind you, nothing too taxing. Just a little jaunt along the coast, the odd picnic in the hills. Well, my nerves being what they are, I've never felt competent enough to drive myself, and Marilyn didn't really feel up to it. We had got rid of my old chauffeur along with the rest of the staff. And so...
So you engaged another one?
Marilyn engaged one. His name was Charles. I had no objection to her choice. My own newfound happiness was such that I was scarcely aware of him.
What was he like?
Charles? Oh, he was in his mid-twenties, I suppose. I dare say handsome, in an obvious sort of way. But, as I say, I was hardly aware. Not until that night. The night when... Oh, Oh, my God. Dear God. Dear God. That night is still with me. I woke up with a start from a very deep sleep. Marilyn had taken care to give me my usual quota of sleeping pills, but for some reason on this particular night, they hadn't done the trick. Perhaps it was meant. Well, for several minutes I just lay there, perspiring heavily, getting my bearings, aware only of the ticking of the clock. Then I called out for Marilyn. Yes, I didn't want to disturb her, but I needed another sedative badly. But when she didn't answer, I got up and went to her room. She wasn't there. At first, I thought she must have got up for something, too. Until I saw her bed hadn't been slept in. It was almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I was a little alarmed, so I began to look for her. Marilyn? Marilyn? It wasn't until I reached the downstairs living room, which opens onto the patio, that I heard voices. I opened the patio doors. The voices were clearer now. My wife and our chauffeur together at the pool. I understood at once. It was pitch black, and they'd taken the precaution of not turning on the pool light. But I could hear them laughing and talking in low, intimate voices. I heard them climb the steps to the high board and dive together into the deep water. I stood there, heartsick. The effort to simply hold on to myself was unbearable. My first instinct had been to rush out and confront them, but I couldn't bear the thought of such a scene. So instead, I waited until they eventually left the pool. They lay together in each other's arms, not 10 feet from where I stood. I listened.
Why did you ever leave me?
Oh, I don't know. I did then. At the time, it seemed the only possible answer. But I know I never stopped loving you, not for a single second. Which, in a funny way, is why I had to leave you in the first place.
That doesn't make sense.
Let's just say, an instinct, shall we?
Instinct?
Yeah. And the kind of life we were living together must one day have killed that love.
It wasn't so bad.
Wasn't it? Diving exhibitions at second-rate summer resorts, the odd gala. Hardly enough to keep body and soul alive. Endless drag from one dreary hotel room to the next.
So you sold out and settled for this instead.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound like that.
Settled for both of us, Chuck. Oh, but you still don't know whether to believe that or not, do you? To believe that I only ever wanted this for us. All along.
I don't know what to believe. When I'm lying here with you like this, well, it's just a sharing you with him, I suppose. Seeing you together. Catching the odd, unexpected glimpse of you both in that damn driving mirror. Seeing him look at you that way, as though you were really his. Seeing him reach out to touch you.
Chuck.
Seeing you smile back. Seeing you return the touch.
Please.
But worst of all, knowing that though you're lying here with me now, in a little while you'll be gone. Because there's still some part of you that belongs to him.
Not belongs. It never has. It never can. It never will.
I wish I could be sure of that.
He's a sick man, Chuck. Sicker than he even suspects. A year, 2 years, a little longer maybe. But it's not so important, is it? We can wait. Because we know that one day there's only going to be us, Chuck. All this and us. Just the two of us.
Just the two of us.
Hold me. Hold me close.
What did you do?
Do? Oh, the conventional thing, I'm afraid. The next day, I engaged a firm of detectives.
To make inquiries about Charles.
They only told me what I more or less knew already. That he was a swimmer who teamed up with Marilyn to do exhibition diving the summer before I met her. The rest was obvious. When I became ill, she had sent for him to solace her loneliness, shall we say. Then, as I grew better, she stumbled on the idea of employing him as our chauffeur. You can understand my dilemma.
Yes, yes, I am beginning to.
I was just recovering from a serious nervous illness, a breakdown, a scene, a quarrel would undo the weeks of convalescence. Now, of all times, it was impossible for me to have it out with Marilyn, to send Charles packing, to do what any other man would have done instantly. It was a weakness, but I couldn't overcome it.
So?
I dissembled. I pretended I knew nothing. I waited. I racked my brains for some way of letting Marilyn know that I knew, and yet avoiding that inevitable scene.
Well, did you eventually find a way?
Oh, yes. I saw how it could be done. Quietly. Without any fuss.
Tell me about it.
Oh. Well, Marilyn wanted to go to the movies in Santa Barbara. I declined, but said Charles should drive her, as I didn't like her to be out on her own at night. She saw me to bed and watched me ostensibly taking my sleeping tablets. I heard the car drive away and imagined handsome Charles, Chuck, sitting confidently beside her at the wheel. After a while, I got up. I had plenty of time.
Plenty of time for what?
To arrange the hint. The hint that would let them know when they got back that I was fully aware of what was happening between them.
Oh, go on.
It was well after midnight when they got back. Very dark. A hot, sultry night. Just the night for a swim. Marilyn didn't even come up to her room, but went with Charles directly to his. And a few minutes later, I heard them laughing softly as they came out and went towards the pool. It was inky dark. But I knew they were climbing the diving tower. The high board creaked as they stepped out onto it. And creaked again, sharply, as each one dived off into the pool. Marilyn first, then Charles right behind her. Their little game they enjoyed so much. It was too dark to see a foot in front of you, but of course to swimmers of their skill it made no difference. In fact, I rather imagine it added to their fun.
And your hint, did it work? I mean, did it break up the affair?
Oh, yes. It broke up all right. The affair ended that very night. A truly effective hint when I finally thought of it. You see, my friend, that evening, as soon as they had left the house, I opened each of the four valves and drained all the water out of the swimming pool.
The man watched me. Waited. I could think of nothing to say. After what seemed an eternity of silence between us, the train entered a tunnel. It was like the fall of a curtain.
Also starring in The Man Who Hated Scenes was Peter Cushing with Diana Olson and Steve Preston. The Man Who Hated Scenes was first recounted by Robert Arthur, dramatized by William Ingram, and produced by John Dyer.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do.
The kitchens of today can be more beautiful than 1949 because this year there's a better, brighter, self-polishing floor wax. It's 1949 Glow Coat. Yes, bright as it's always been, this year Glow Coat is brighter than ever, better than any. Try 1949 Glow Coat on your linoleum this week.
I have only recently discovered the CBS Radio Workshop. This excellent radio series ran on CBS, kind of obviously there, huh? From January the 27th of 1956 until September the 22nd of 1957. A revival of the earlier Columbia Workshop, which was broadcast by CBS from 1936 until 1943, of particular interest to those of you who are listening to this show, they adapted the work of Robert Heinlein, Edgar Allan Poe, Frederick Pohl, James Thurber, Mark Twain, Thomas Wolfe, H.L. Mencken. I haven't heard many of these yet. The one today is an adaptation of a very Swiftian, and by Swiftian I certainly do not mean Tom Swift, although I will admit that the science in this story doesn't really even achieve that level. To think of this story, A Pride of Carrots, or Venus Well Served, as science fiction would be a mistake. It's fantasy, but it's wonderful fantasy. It was adapted from the work of the very successful poet and novelist, Robert Nathan, and is extremely entertaining. I think it will remind you of Jonathan Swift's 1726 novel, Gulliver's Travel. That may seem like inordinately high praise for a radio show, and I guess for a radio show it is. But I'll tell you what. Take about a half an hour here and listen to this.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop.
Well, folks, that just about winds up tonight's broadcast from the interplanetary rocket ship American Initiative. If Commander Potter's astral navigation continues to hold as true as it has so far, I will be broadcasting to you tomorrow night at this time from the planet Venus, which even now looms dead ahead of us, brighter and somewhat larger than our own moon. This is J. Alexander Caudill speaking for Caledonia Oil, Shirley White Toothpaste, Inus Clinus Knock Beer, and Bar None Dog Food, and returning you now to the CBS studios on Earth.
CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, A Pride of Carrots, or Venus Well Served, by the noted American novelist Robert Nathan. And here to tell his story is Mr. Nathan himself.
According to recent newspaper reports, scientists have been hearing strange and mysterious radio signals which they are convinced are broadcast from the planet Venus. And this may very well be the case. No one knows for certain that life exists on the other planets, but then no one can say for certain that it does not. And if it does, no one can say what form that life may take. One man's guess is as good as another's, and this is mine. This is the way Venus looks to me.
Yeah, feels good to stretch your legs again.
Sure does. You feel heavier or lighter?
Just normal.
Then the gravity's about the same as Earth. Look there.
What?
A daisy. You can take off your helmet.
You sure?
Sure. The presence of flora indicates the presence of air.
Quite good air, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that rocket was getting a little musty. Well, this is a solemn moment, Commander.
It is indeed, Caudill, the first man on Venus. Hand me the flag, will you?
Oh, here you are.
I hereby claim this planet for the United States of America.
Through the courtesy of Caledonia Oil, Shirley White Toothpaste, Inus Kleinus Knocked Beer, and Barnum Dog Food.
Oh, really, Caudle, must you?
Well, it's in my contract.
But we aren't on the air.
Well, a little rehearsal never hurt anyone. Anyway, we will be as soon as the tubes on this walkie-talkie warm up. 1, 2, 3, 4, testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, testing. There we are. CBS on Earth from Caudle on Venus. CBS on Earth from Caudle on Venus. How do you read me? That's funny. They're standing by around the clock on this frequency. Earth from Venus. Earth from Venus. Come in, Earth.
Maybe freak atmospherics.
Oh, fine. At a time like this to run into freak... Potter.
Yes?
Do you see what I see over there in those bushes?
Speaking of freaks...
What is it?
Well, it looks like a little horse.
Yeah, but it's got wings and a sort of beak.
And a tail like a kangaroo. And it's coming this way.
Yeah, where's the ray gun?
I'll get it.
All right, stand back, you filthy beast. Go away. Go away.
I beg your pardon?
You talk?
Oh, naturally I talk. So do you. Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
Certainly not.
Oh, I'm sure I have. Oh, yes, on CBS. The outside of the inside of the news. You're J. Alexander Caudle.
Do you mean to say you get our programs here on Venus?
Venus? What do you mean, Venus? You're from Venus up there. We call it the evening star at certain times of the year.
But that's Earth.
Nonsense. This is Earth. That's Venus. Silly, isn't it? But that's semantics for you. For instance, what would you call a group of carrots?
Bunch.
Bunch? Oh, good heavens, no. A pride of carrots. That is, of course, on this side of the border. And a gaggle of onions. But if you were on the other side of the border, it would be an exaltation of onions and a deceit of carrots. Semantics, you see. It depends on your point of view.
I see.
A charm of griffins.
You are a griffin, I take it?
Of course. Rather highly placed, as a matter of fact. Now, you notice my gold collar? I belong to the Secretary of the Interior. My name is Fido.
And the Secretary?
A very able carrot. Quite famous in his own right, but even more so for his wife's tassel. You've seen ordinary carrots, no doubt, with their green tops. But this is a most unusual tassel. Blue! Everyone is copying it.
How does it happen that you, an animal, belong to a vegetable?
Well, one has to eat.
Vegetables?
Oh, dear, no. Caraway seeds, truffles, marzipan. You look a little like marzipan yourself. You mind if I try...
Hey, cut it out! Stop biting me!
Delicious, but definitely not marzipan. What is it?
Meat, you fool!
You don't say. Meat! I never tasted meat before.
You're meat yourself.
I am? Splendid. I'll just try me. Ooh, that hurt.
Well, of course it hurt. Now stop this nonsense and lead us to your master.
Oh, yes, of course. That's why I'm here, isn't it? Follow me, fellow animals.
They had not walked far through fields of charming wildflowers which sang like birds until they came to a shady bower of massive ferns. In the middle, reclining on a soft bed of lettuce leaves, were two carrots, much like any other carrot you may have encountered, excepting that one had a tassel of the most brilliant blue. The carrot with a standard green tassel rose as they approached.
Welcome to our planet.
Well, thank you.
In the name of the United States Navy,
Potter, later. Your Majesty, that is, Your Majesties.
We are not Majesties. This is a republic. I am Edwin, Secretary of the Interior, and this is my wife, Edwina.
And you're the famous news commentator, J. Alexander Caudle, and your Commander Potter.
Well, precisely, madam.
We've been watching your trip ever since your takeoff, until we lost you when you rounded Mars. You're most welcome.
Well, thank you, madam. You can perhaps conceive the feelings with which Commander Potter and I gaze upon this unfamiliar scene. The first mortals ever to... What's that?
Oh, that's my daughter Alice. She knows all the latest songs. She says she's a cool cat, whatever that is.
Hi, everybody. Company?
Yes, dear. Come here and meet our visitors from outer space. Mr. Caudle, Commander Carter.
Oh, I know all about the mother. Welcome to Caratania, gentlemen.
I have already welcomed them, Alice.
Oh, you don't understand the animal kingdom, Father. They'd much rather be welcomed by a young girl.
Really, Alice? Where do you learn such things?
At school, in zoology class.
And where did you learn that song?
I watch your television all the time. I want to be a great actress and sell cigarettes. You think I'm mad?
No, that sounds like a very normal ambition to me.
Oh, I like you, Potter. You interest me.
Now, Alice, you simply must stop this prattle. We're all a little on edge, I'm afraid. This last day of waiting has been... Well, after all, they could have landed in Onionopolis.
But they didn't. The onions didn't get them. We got them.
The onions?
Yes. You see, our planet is divided into two countries. The Democratic Union of Keratania and the United Socialist Republics of Leeks and Onions. They are constantly threatening us with war.
Well, why?
They want us to be onions.
But that's absurd.
Of course it's absurd, especially when you realize that the only possible thing for everyone to be, if he wants to live a decent kind of life, is a carrot.
Oh, naturally.
But the onions won't see it our way, and they can't be trusted. I'm given to understand that they plan to use nematodes. It's race suicide, of course.
Nematodes? How do you think? Well, aren't they the tiny worms that all but ruined the citrus in California back in the 40s?
I don't know much about citrus. Not exactly my line, you know. But here, the nematodes eat vegetables, a kind of virus, too small to see. We've tried to outlaw them, but the onions won't agree. Ah, well, we'll wipe each other out, I suppose, and the spiders can take over. It's sad to think about. Just spider webs everywhere.
You know, it seems to me that they worked out a way to fumigate for nematodes out in California. See, if I could just get through to CBS on Earth, I could find out.
You've had difficulties getting through?
Well, at any rate, Earth isn't getting through to me.
I'm sure we could get you through on a planet-to-planet hookup, particularly if you can find out anything about fumigating for nematodes.
Hey, Commander, you hear that? We're going on the air after all.
Oh, splendid. You want me to make a prepared report, or shall we ad-lib?
Well, you better type the report. You can ad-lib to your wife.
Oh, you have a wife, Potter.
Oh, yes, my dear. Every Navy man over a full lieutenant has a wife.
A woman, I presume?
Oh, yes, definitely. Has to be, you know.
What is your wife like, Potter?
Why, she's female, like this.
How odd. Bumpy, isn't she?
Well,
You're not bumpy, Potter.
No, I suppose not.
Yes, well, Your Excellency, how soon do you think you can get us on the air?
We should be able to have it set up in a few hours.
Well, now, my regular spot is 8:30 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You think you can make it?
We'll do our best.
Oh, great. Hey, this calls for a celebration. It's too bad we haven't a bottle of champagne.
Champagne? What's that?
Well, a kind of bubbly wine.
Wine is made from grapes, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure I like the idea. Some of our best friends are grapes.
Yes, well, don't worry, ma'am. We haven't any champagne anyway.
We could break out our emergency rations.
Now, that's a fine idea.
Got a can opener?
Sure, right here. You care to join us, Your Excellency?
Well, I don't know. May I see that can, please?
Oh, sure. Here you are.
U.S. Navy for emergency use only. Concentrated carrot juice.
Oh, Potter,
seize these men. Put them under arrest. They're onions in disguise.
Our scene shifts now to Onionopolis, capital of the United Socialist Republic of Leeks and Onions, which controls half of the planet Venus. We are in the office of the Secretary General of the party, a large, fat, white onion named Odor, as General Shallot enters.
Death to carrots.
Death to carrots. Well, General.
The rumor has been verified by the underground. They landed near Carrotopolis this morning.
How did you permit this to happen, General?
Unfortunately, our side of the planet was turned away from the direction they were traveling, so they landed on the backside, comrade.
Excuses, excuses. We must have those spacemen, General. We must have their technical skill before the carrots get it, or we will be in the soup.
Yes, comrade.
It is insufferable that we who invented television, jet propulsion, the atomic bomb and the bicycle should be deprived of these two men who can tell us how to use them. It is an outrage, a national insult. Death to carrots.
Likewise.
I want those two spacemen.
It may be difficult, comrade.
You could call me Excellency or Little Father. Everyone does.
I am a descendant of the Daleks. A Dalek does not call anything excellency.
Of course, I was only joking. Here we are all comrades, all excellencies, little fathers. Except Leeks, of course.
Of course. Death to carrots.
Death to carrots. By the way, General, what are you doing tonight?
Imperialistic warmongers. Nothing.
Capitalistic schwein. Come have dinner with me.
Decadent bourgeois. Love to.
And those spacemen must be bourgeois, too, or they would have landed here.
Possibly.
Undoubtedly, but we will change their point of view once we have made them our guests, eh, comrade?
That might not be so wise, comrade.
Why not? Don't you want to learn how to set off guided missiles and ride bicycles?
That is not the point, comrade. If we abduct these spacemen, we give Caratania a splendid opportunity to protest. And you must remember, comrade, protests are weapons, too. The very best weapons. They cost nothing, and properly used, they create an odor. A real onion odor.
Then you are opposed to kidnapping these spacemen.
Definitely.
Very well. I shall think about it. You could go, General.
Thank you, comrade.
Oh, by the way, I have news for you. You have just been promoted to field marshal.
Thank you, comrade. Strength to onion.
Strength to onion. See you at dinner.
Death to carrots. I'll be there.
Death to carrots, 8:30 sharp. Hello? Secret police? General Shallet has just left my office. Liquidate him.
I'm hungry. I wonder when they feed their prisoners in this lousy jail.
What difference does it make unless you have an appetite for bone meal, ammonium sulfate, and peat moss?
Ugh. Guess I'm not hungry after all.
You shouldn't have shown him the label on the can, old man. That's what did it.
Well, how could I tell? I thought it'd be chicken consomme. It
usually is.
Just when I had the greatest broadcast in history lined up.
Now what?
There's a lady to see you.
Miss Alice.
Shh, not so loud. Thank you, Sergeant. You can leave us now.
Mind you, Miss Alice, this is contrary to your father's orders and against my better judgment.
Oh, I know, Sergeant, but it's utterly divine of you.
I shall be just outside. Scream if you need help.
You wouldn't hurt me, would you, Potter?
Glad to have you aboard, ma'am.
They say that you're dangerous vegetarians, that you eat carrots. Do you really?
Well, you see, ma'am...
I don't believe it. You're much too nice to eat poor little me.
Thank you, ma'am.
You know, you yourself are a vegetarian, Miss Alice.
I am not. I'm a vegetable. It's not the same thing at all.
Well, now, just answer me this. What will happen to you when you die?
I'll be buried, of course. In the national compost heap.
Uh-huh, from which the rich, steaming soil is taken to nourish the young carrots, right?
Of course.
Which then must of necessity feed upon your decayed flesh.
Why, of course. Why, how madly amusing. I really did eat my ancestors, didn't I? Oh, but I missed Mother and Father.
Well, I should hope so.
But now what could be more satisfying to a girl's psyche than to have her father under her belt?
Oh, have you been through analysis?
Of course, haven't you?
Well, yes.
Oh, it's so nice to be able to talk the same language, isn't it? My analyst says the trouble with me is my mother has a blue top.
Exactly. The active competition of an adult parent.
It tends to make me aggressive. Kiss me, Potter.
Huh? What?
Kiss me.
Good Lord, really, I...
Are you afraid, Potter? It isn't even spring. I don't come into blossom till July.
Well, I know, but...
Am I not beautiful? Am I not to be desired by the Navy?
Oh, yes, indeed, but...
I could have your head, Potter, on a silver tray, like Salome.
I know, but...
I could set you free.
Well, for heaven's sake, kiss her and get it over with. No, but...
Oh, you smell so good. Like a grocery store.
Ooh, it's like April. Is this love, Potter?
How can I feel this way about a carrot?
I feel a strange heat. Not like the sun.
Like a garden in the summer.
I don't feel at all like a vegetable.
I wouldn't have thought it possible.
Look, how about getting us out of here?
The time is up, folks.
Oh, yes, I suppose it is. Oh, but don't worry, my darling. I'll be back. I'll be back quickly to set you free. You'll see.
Well, there's the Navy for you. What have you fellas got that I haven't got?
Blossoms in our hair.
Ah. You, really like the girl, don't you?
Yes.
Well, now, of course, it's none of my business, but, what about Mrs. Potter?
What about her?
Well, she isn't going to like this pretty vegetable of yours.
Caudle, could you be jealous of a stalk of celery?
I am not married.
No, of course, that does make a difference. Oh, I wish we were safe at home. There's something frightening about being in love with a carrot.
You smell anything, Commander?
No.
That's funny. For a moment, I thought I smelled onions.
Well, that's not very likely.
I don't know. My eyes are watering.
Mine, too. You know, I do smell onions.
Gentlemen.
Who are you?
You are free, gentlemen.
She did manage it then.
This way. Hurry, please.
Where is she? I can't see very well. My eyes are full of tears.
She's waiting for you, sir.
Just a minute, Commander. This isn't a carrot. It's an onion.
Take them, comrades.
So you see, gentlemen, we have no choice. The stakes were too high, being no less than war or peace.
What are you talking about?
Simply this, Commander Potter of the U.S. Navy. How do you make war?
How do we do what?
Make war. How do you destroy whole armies, cities, countries, with all their inhabitants, without, at the same time, annihilating yourselves? Unfortunately, there is no blight that will make compost out of carrots without doing the same for onions. I have to think of my people.
Bless you, little father.
Thank you, Spindleskull. You see, Commander, we are still in the drawing board stage. We need technicians.
Don't look at me.
My dear Commander, you must understand that the end justifies the means. When onions rule the world, who would wish to be a carrot? I offer you an important place in history.
The only place I want to be is next to a girl with a carrot top who smells like a garden after rain.
Now, let us not grow emotional. But perhaps you are closer to her than you think. Will you teach us to make war, Commander? You see, I am giving you another chance. Opportunity rarely knocks so often.
I will not.
Very well. Perhaps we will find a way to make you change your mind. There is a little experiment I am planning with a pot of boiling water. How would you like to see your, shall we say, girlfriend floating about with only a marrow bone for company? A quite excellent soup, petite marmite, I believe it is called.
You're bluffing.
Am I? We shall see. Spindle.
Yes, little father.
Take these gentlemen to the solarium and entertain them. Show them the vampire marigolds and the lizard-eating oleander, and they might be amused to watch the muerte vine digest its daily mouse.
I warn you, Odor, the United States Navy will not take this lying down.
Nor will CBS.
This way, animals. Send in the other prisoner. Well, well, come in, young lady. Don't be bashful. I won't eat you.
What do you want with me? Why did you bring me here?
I suppose you wouldn't care to tell me the whereabouts of the Carrot 8 Army. No? Oh, youth, so stupid, so impulsive, so desirable, but so uncooperative. By the way, your friend Commander Potter is here. He, too, has proven uncooperative. We may have to press him a little.
He wouldn't dare.
He is being shown the muerte vines at this very moment.
Not the meat eaters.
Why not? The commander is meat, I believe.
Oh, no, not that.
Of course, I could be persuaded to change my mind. Oh, you have such lovely skin, my dear. So moist and tender.
Please.
You smell good, too, like a salad. Fragrant, but delicate. What freshness, what youth. I adore you.
I loathe you.
You do not realize your situation. One word from me, you are in the soup.
I would 1,000 times...
Or what is perhaps more to the point, your friend Mr. Potter is left alone with the vampire marigolds.
Oh, no.
Oh, that fetches you. You really care for him, don't you?
More than life.
All the better. It's much more exciting to make love to a woman already in love. Adds a kind of seasoning, as it were.
You nettle. You noisome weed.
Splendid. So sweet and so hot, almost like a Spanish onion.
Is this the way you make war? On women and children?
War? Who is making war? I am making love.
You are odious to me.
Very well. We will try, Mr. Potter, in the muerte vines.
No. I can't stand it.
You give up? You give in?
Will he have a safe conduct back to my father?
Yes.
Will there be one for me?
Later.
Write it out.
But of course. for Mr. Potter, a pass. Also for Mr. Caudle, and now for Miss Alice.
Yes, Little Father?
Spindle, you will let the spaceman go, and you will see that this lady is returned to her own people later.
It shall be done, Little Father.
Now, divine creature, at last you are mine.
No, no, stand back.
Silly girl, drop that paper knife and receive the kiss of the little father.
No, no! It is thus a carrot kisses.
Alice!
Oh, Potter, Potter, thank heavens you're safe.
You're crying.
It's nothing, nothing. It's only onion juice. Here, your passes. Go quickly, both of you.
And you?
I must wait for a little while. If I go with you now, they'll be suspicious.
No. If we have to die, then we'll die together.
Oh, no, no, my dear Potter. That wouldn't help my country, or this little world, or even me. I've become very sensible, Potter, very realistic. Don't you see? It doesn't matter about me. But you, you, Potter, you're the hope of the future. Look, I'll try to catch up to you at the frontier. If I don't come, be kind to Carrots, Potter, for my sake. Go now, and God bless you.
Come on, Potter, we're on the air in an hour.
Hurry, hurry, they're coming back.
I'm staying with you.
No, no, my dearest Potter, go. Go, the world needs you. The universe needs you.
Come on, Potter.
Farewell then, my dearest Alice.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of Earth and other species throughout the planetary system. This is J. Alexander Caudle, bringing you the very first broadcast from Venus. Through the courtesy of Caledonia Oil, Shirley White Toothpaste, Einus Kleinus Nuck Beer, and Bar None Dog Food. Oh, excuse me a moment, ladies and gentlemen. There's some confusion here in the studio. We've just received a bulletin. What's that? Oh, no. Alice? In the soup?
And I'll need a pound of peas.
Pound of peas.
And a cauliflower.
Cauliflower. You must be very happy to have your husband back again, Mrs. Potter. And all those write-ups in the papers, my goodness. Did he really get to Venus like they said? I missed the broadcast.
Yes, he did. A bottle of ketchup.
A bottle of ketchup. Mm-hmm. You know, he looks a little thin in his pictures. I guess maybe they didn't have much to eat up there.
I guess not.
What was it like? Did he tell you?
He hasn't said much. 4 dozen onions.
4 dozen?
That's right. He eats them all the time. Raw.
Raw? They say onions are good for colds.
I know.
There's lots of things like that, like carrots make your hair curly.
Oh, he won't touch carrots.
He won't. Not even cooked.
Not even cooked. I served a petite marmite the other night, and he got up and left the table.
No! Now, isn't that something?
One sack of peat moss.
What's that for?
He says he's got blossoms in his hair.
That'll be $3.47, Mrs. Potter. I'll have someone take them out to the car for you.
Thank you.
Goodbye now. Blossoms in his hair? In February?
The CBS Radio Workshop, produced in Hollywood by William N. Robeson, has presented A Pride of Carrots, or Venus Well Served, by Robert Mason, with the author as narrator. A Pride of Carrots was adapted for the workshop by Mr. Robeson, who also directed the production. Heard in the cast were Helene Burke, June Foray, Tracy Roberts, Dawes Butler, Ted Bliss, Richard Hale, Alan Reed, Sam Pierce, and Bill Thompson. The original score was composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith. ¶¶
truth is stranger than fiction. This is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not.
Sultan Murad IV inherited 240 wives when he assumed the throne of Turkey. He decided to dispense with them by putting each wife in a sack and tossing them one by one into the Bosporus, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a man who walked to Russia.
Okay, one last break here and then we'll be right back.
Colonel Russell Farnham of New Hampshire walked from St. Louis, Missouri to St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, Russia, in 1812 and 13. Carrying a 20-pound pack and gun, he followed the Missouri River to the waters of the Columbia River, then up the Pacific coast to Alaska. He crossed the frozen Bering Strait to Siberia and on to the Russian capital. He won wide acclaim, and Tsar Alexander I named him the lone conqueror of two continents, believe it or not.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joseph Canna. The Crawling Chaos by H.P. Lovecraft. Of the pleasures and pains of opium much has been written. The ecstasies and horrors of De Quincey and the Paradise Artificialis of Baudelaire are preserved and interpreted with an art which makes them immortal, and the world knows well the beauty, the terror, and the mystery of those obscure realms into which the inspired dreamer is transported. But much, as has been told, no man has yet dared intimate the nature of the phantasms thus unfolded to the mind, or hint at the direction of the unheard-of roads along whose ornate and exotic course the partaker of the drug is so irresistibly borne. De Quincey was drawn back into Asia, that teeming land of nebulous shadows whose hideous antiquity is so impressive that the vast age of the race and name overpowers the sense of youth in the individual. But farther than that he dared not go. Those who have gone farther seldom returned, and even when they have been either silent or quite mad. I took opium once. In the year of the plague, when the doctors sought to deaden the agonies they could not cure, there was an overdose. My physician was worn out with horror and exertion, and I traveled very far indeed. In the end I returned and lived, but my nights are filled with strange memories, nor have I permitted a doctor to give me opium again. The pain and pounding in my head had been quite unendurable when the drug was administered. Of the future I had no heed. To escape, whether by cure, unconsciousness, or death, was all that concerned me. I was partly delirious, so that it is hard to place the exact moment of transition, but I think the effect must have begun shortly before the pounding ceased to be painful. As I have said, there was an overdose, so my reactions were probably far from normal. The sensation of falling, curiously disassociated from the idea of gravity or direction, was paramount. Though there were subsidiary impressions of unseen throngs and incalculable profusion, throngs of infinitely diverse nature, but all more or less related to me. Sometimes it seemed less as though I were falling than as though the universe or the ages were falling past me. Suddenly my pain ceased, and I began to associate the pounding with an external rather than internal force. The falling had ceased also, giving place to a sensation of uneasy temporary rest. And when I listened closely, I fancied the pounding was that of the vast, inscrutable sea as its sinister, colossal breakers lacerated some desolate shore after a storm of titanic magnitude. Then I opened my eyes. For a moment my surroundings seemed confused, like a projected image hopelessly out of focus. But gradually I realized my solitary presence in a strange and beautiful room lighted by many windows. Of the exact nature of the apartment I could form no idea, for my thoughts were still from settled, but I noticed van-colored rugs and draperies, elaborately fashioned tables, chairs, ottomans and divans, and delicate vases and ornaments which conveyed a suggestion of the exotic without actually being alien. These things I noticed, yet they were not long uppermost in my mind. Slowly but inexorably, crawling upon my consciousness and rising above every other impression, came a dizzying fear of the unknown, a fear of the greater because I could not analyze it, and seeming to concern a stealthily approaching menace, not death, but some nameless, unheard-of thing inexpressibly more ghastly and abhorrent, and shrank from glancing through the arched lattice windows that opened so bewilderingly on every hand. Perceiving shutters attached to these windows, I closed them all, averting my eyes from the exterior as I did so. Then, employing a flint and steel which I found on one of the small tables, I lit many candles reposing the walls in arabesque sconces. The added sense of security brought by closed shutters and artificial light calmed my nerves to some degree. But I could not shut out the monotonous pounding. Now that I was calmer, the sound became as fascinated as it was fearful, and I felt a contradictory desire to seek out its source, despite my still powerful shrinking. Opening a portiere on the side of the room nearing the pounding, I beheld a small and richly draped corridor, ending in a cavern door and large oriel windows. To this window I was irresistibly drawn, though my ill-defined apprehension seemed almost equally bent on holding me back. As I approached it, I could see a chaotic whirl of waters in the distance. Then, as I attained it and glanced out on all sides, the stupendous picture of my surroundings burst upon me with full and devastating force. I beheld such a sight as I had never beheld before, and which no living person can have seen save in the delirium of fever or the inferno of opium. The building stood on a narrow point of land, or what was now a narrow point of land, fully 300 feet above what must lately have been a seething vortex of mad water. On either side of the house there was a newly washed-out precipice of red earth, whilst ahead of me the hideous waves were still rolling and frightfully eating away the land with ghastly monotony and deliberation. Out a mile or more there rose and fell menacing breakers at least 50 feet in height, and on the far horizon ghoulish black clouds of grotesque contour were resting and brooding like unwholesome vultures. The waves were dark and purplish, almost black, and clutched at the yielding red mud of the bank as if it with uncouth greedy hands, and could not but feel that some noxious marine mine had declared a war of extermination upon all the solid ground, perhaps abetted by the angry sky. Recovering at length from the stupor into which this unnatural spectacle had thrown me, I realized that my physical danger was acute. Even whilst I gazed, the bank had lost many feet, and it could not be long before the house would fall undermined into this awful pit of lashing waves. Accordingly, I hastened to the opposite side of the edifice, and finding a door emerged at once, unlocking it after me with a curious key which had hung inside. I now beheld more of the strange region about me, and marked a singular division which seemed to exist in the hostile ocean and firmament. On each side of the jutting promontory different conditions held sway. At my left, as I faced inland, was a gently heaving sea with great green waves rolling peacefully in under a brightly shining sun. Something about that sun's nature and position made me shudder, but I could not tell then, and cannot tell now, what it was. At my right also was the sea, but it was blue, calm, and only gently undulating, while the sky above it was darker and the washed-out bank more nearly white than reddish. I now turned my attention to the land, and found occasion for fresh surprise, for the vegetation resembled nothing I had seen or read about. It was apparently tropical, or at least subtropical, a conclusion born out of the intense heat of the air. Sometimes, I thought, I could trace strange analogies with the flora of my native land, fancying the well-known plants and shrubs might assume such forms under the radical change of climate, but that gigantic and omnipresent palm trees were plainly foreign. The house I had just left was very small, hardly more than a cottage, but its material was evidently marble, and its architecture was weird and composite, involving a quaint fusion of Western and Eastern forms. At the corners were Corinthian columns, but the red tile roof was like that of a Chinese pagoda. From the door inland there stretched a path of singularly white sand, about 4 feet wide, and lined either side with strange palms, unidentifiable flowering shrubs and plants. It lay toward the side of the promontory, where the sea was blue and the bank rather whitish. Down this path I felt impelled to flee, as if pursued by some malignant spirit from the pounding ocean. At first it was slightly uphill. Then I reached a gentle crest. Behind me I saw the scene I had left, the entire point with the cottage and black water, with the green sea on one side and the blue sea on the other, and a curse unnamed and unnameable lowering over all. I never saw it again, and often wonder. After this last look, I strode ahead and surveyed the inland panorama before me. The path, as I have intimated, ran along the right-hand shore as one went inland. Ahead and to the left, I now viewed a magnificent valley comprising thousands of acres and covered with a swaying growth of tropical grass higher than my head. Almost at the limit of vision was a colossal palm tree, which seemed to fascinate and beckon me. By this time, wonder and escape from the imperiled peninsula had largely dissipated my fear. But as I paused and sank fatigued to the path, idly digging with my hands into the warm, whitish-golden sand, a new and acute sense of danger seized me. Some terror in the swishing tall grass seemed added to that of the diabolically pounding sea, and I started up crying in disjointly, "Tiger! Tiger! Is it tiger? Beast? Beast? Is it beast that I am afraid of?" My mind wandered back to the ancient and classical story of tigers, which I had read. I strove to recall the author, but had difficulty. Then, in the midst of my fear, I remembered that the tale was by Rudyard Kipling, nor did the grotesqueness of deeming him an ancient author occur to me. I wished for the volume containing this story, and had almost started back toward the doomed cottage to procure it, when my better sense and the lure of the palm prevented me. Whether or not I could have resisted the backward beckoning without the counter-fascination of this vast palm tree, I do not know. This attraction was now dominant, and I left the path and crawled on hands and knees down the valley's slope despite my fears of the grass and of the serpents it might contain. I resolved to fight for life and reason as long as possible against all menaces of land or sea, though I sometimes feared defeat as the maddening swish of the uncanny grasses joined the still audible and irritating pounding of the distant breakers. I would frequently pause and put my hands to my ears for relief, but could never quite shut out the detestable sound. It was, as it seemed to me, only after ages that I finally dragged myself to the beckoning palm tree and lay quiet beneath its protecting shade. There now ensued a series of incidents which transported me to the opposite extremes of ecstasy and horror, incidents which I trembled to recall and dare not seek to interpret. No sooner had I crawled beneath the overhanging foliage of the palm than there dropped from its branches a young child of such beauty as I never beheld before. Though ragged and dusty, this being bore the features of a faun or demigod, and seemed almost to diffuse a radiance in the dense shadow of the tree. It smiled and extended its hand, but before I could arise and speak, I heard in the upper air the exquisite melody of singing, notes high and low blent with the sublime and ethereal harmoniousness. The sun had by this time sunk below the horizon, and in the twilight I saw an aureole of lambent light encircled the child's head. Then in a tone of silver it addressed me. "It is the end. They have come down through the gloaming from the stars. Now all is over, and beyond the Arinurian streams we shall dwell blissfully in Tello." As the child spoke, I beheld a soft radiance through the leaves of the palm tree, and rising, greeted a pair whom I knew to be the chief singers among those I had heard. A god and goddess they must have been, for such beauty is not mortal. And they took my hand, saying, "Come, child, you have heard the voices, and all is well. In Tello beyond the Milky Way, and in the Arinurian streams, are cities all of amber and chalcedony. And upon their domes of many facets glisten the images of strange and beautiful stars. Under the ivory bridges of Tello flow rivers of liquid gold, bearing the pleasure barges bound for Blasphemy Cytherean of the Seven Suns. And in Tello and Cytherean abide only youth, beauty, and pleasure, nor are any sounds heard save of laughter, song, and the lute. Only the gods dwell in Tello of the golden rivers, but among them shalt thou dwell." As I listened, enchanted, I suddenly became aware of the change in my surroundings. The palm tree, so lately overshadowed my exhausting form, was now some distance to my left, and considerably below me. I was obviously floating in the atmosphere, companioned not only by the strange child and the radiant pair, but by a constantly increasing throng of half-luminous, vine-crowned youths and maidens with wind-blown hair and joyful countenance. We slowly ascended together, as if borne on a fragrant breeze, which blew not from the earth, but from the golden nebula, and the child whispered in my ear that I must look always upward to the pathways of light, and never backward to the sphere I had just left. The youths and maidens now chanted mellifluous choriambics to the accompaniment of lutes, and I felt enveloped in a peace and happiness more profound than any I had in life imagined, when the intrusion of a single sound altered my destiny and shattered my soul. Through the ravishing strains of the singers and the lutenists, as if in mocking demonic concord, throbbed from gulfs below the damnable and detestable pounding of that hideous ocean, As those black breakers beat their message into my ears, I forgot the words of the child and looked back down upon the doomed scene from which I thought I had escaped. Down through the ether I saw the accursed earth, slowly turning, ever turning with angry and tempestuous seas, gnawing at the wild, desolate shores and dashing foam against the tottering towers of a deserted cities. And under a ghastly moon there gleamed sights I can never describe, sights I can never forget, deserts of corpse-like clay and jungles of ruin and decadence, where once stretched the populous plains and villages of my native land, and maelstroms of frothing ocean where once rose the mighty temples of my forefathers. Round the northern pole streamed a morass of noisome growths and miasmal vapors, hissing before the onslaught of the ever-mounting waves that curled and fretted from the shuddering deep. Then a rending report clave the night, and athwart the desert of deserts appeared a smoking rift. Still the black ocean foamed and gnawed, eating away the desert on either side as the rift in the center widened and widened. There was now no land left but the desert, and still the fuming ocean ate and ate. All at once, I thought, even the pounding sea seemed afraid of something, afraid of dark gods of the inner earth that are greater than the evil gods of water. But even if it was, it could not turn back, and the desert had suffered too much from those nightmare waves to help them now. So the ocean ate the last of the land and poured into the smoking gulf, thereby giving up all it had ever conquered from the newly flooded lands it flowed again, uncovering death and decay. And from its ancient and immemorial bed it trickled loathsomely, uncovering nighted secrets of the years when time was young and the gods unborn. Above the waves rose weedy remembered spires. The moon laid pale lilies of light on dead London, and Paris stood from its damp grave to be sacrificed with stardust. Then rose spires and monoliths that were weedy but not remembered. Terrible spires and monoliths of land that men never knew were lands. There was not any pounding now, but only the unearthly roaring and hissing of waters tumbling into the rift. The smoke of that rift had changed to steam, and almost hid the world as it grew denser and denser. It seared my face and hands, and when I looked to see how it affected my companions, I found they had all disappeared. Then very suddenly it ended. I knew no more till I awakened upon a bed of convalescence. As the cloud of steam from the plutonic gulf finally concealed the entire surface from my sight, all the firmament shrieked in a sudden agony of mad reverberations which shook the trembling ether. And one delirious flash and burst it happened, one blinding, deafening holocaust of fire, smoke, and thunder that dissolved the wan moon, and it sped outward to the void. And when the smoke cleared, and I sought to look upon the earth, I beheld against a background of cold, humorless stars only the dying sun and the pale, mournful planets searching for their sister.
Well, okay, that's it. That's another Night Transmissions in the can. Well, almost in the can. And before I go, I'm going to give you my email address in hopes that somebody will write me. If you're so disposed, I'm available at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can also drop by the website. There's a contact button there. Oh, the website, as you might expect, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Whenever you're dealing with anything on the internet and night transmissions, www.nighttransmissions.com. There, I said it. See ya.
Up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies flow, round an island there below, the island of Shabbat. Willows white and aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver, through the wave that runs forever, by the island in. Four grey walls and four grey towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent island bows the Lady of Shabbat. Only reapers reaping early in among the beaded valley hear a song that echoes cheer from the river winding clearly, town to town would Camelot. And by the moon the reaper weary, piling sheaves in upland's airy, listening whispers and hears the fairy, the lady of Shabbat. Magic web with colors gay, she has heard a whisper say, a curse is on her if she stayed. Look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaves steadily. Little other care hath she, the lay. Moving through a mirror clear, there hangs before her all the year. Shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. And sometimes through the mirror blue, the knights come riding two and two. She hath no loyal knight and true, the Lady of Shabbat. But in a web she still delights to weave the mirror's magic sights. For often through the silent nights, a funeral with plumes and with lights and music went to Camelot. When the moon was overhead, came two young lovers lately wed. I'm half sick of shams, she said, the Lady of Shabbat. Between the barley sheaves, the sun came dazzling through the leaves and flamed upon the brazen greaves of Baldur's and Lancelot. A red cross knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield that sparkled on the yellow field beside. Broad clear brow in sunlight glowed, on burnished hooves his war horse trode. From underneath his helmet flowed his coal black curls as on he rode, as he rode down to Camelot. From the bank and from the river he flashed into the crystal mirror. floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. The curses come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. In the stormy east wind straining, pale yellow woods were waning, the broad stream in his veins complaining, heavily the low sky raining over Talbot Camelot. Down she came and found a boat beneath the willow left afloat, and round about the prow she down the river's dim expanse, like some bold Serena trance, seeing all his own mischance. With a glassy countenance, she looked to Camelot. And at the closing of the day, she loosed the chain down she lay. Broad stream bore her far away, the Lady of face. God in his mercy lend her grace.